Thank you so much. That was such a warm introduction, and I really appreciate that. This is my first Hope. I'm very happy to be here. With a topic that is near and dear to my heart, I've been doing sex worker rights activism for more than 10 years. And one thing that I noticed that has changed is I felt that in the beginning, a lot of these things were very abstract and on the horizon. I felt more like a distant weather person. And right now, I'm a little bit more in the middle of a hurricane, describing those conditions that we saw coming a while ago. So I'm looking forward to sharing all of this good news. A little bit of who I am. I am a sex worker, so I am a stakeholder in a lot of what I'm talking about. And a lot of what I'm talking about is surveillance. I'm talking about a government dragnet. And there are people here who are far more competent about talking about the nature of that surveillance, who is doing it, way better than I could. I can show you the sex worker eye view of these things, and I can show you why the rationale of human trafficking is bogus. Another project that I do is I am the founder of Harm Redux San Francisco. I am a harm reductionist. All my roots are in harm reduction. So in San Francisco, I hand out health and hygiene supplies for crack smokers, including pipes. We're going to be talking about a lot of the prostitution law. You don't necessarily have to see this whole slide, but I want to cover kind of what are the laws around sex work. And the truth is the criminal penal code is really dense. It's really thick. There's a lot of variation between communities. But as a whole, it comes down to these basic principles. It is illegal to exchange sex for anything of value. It is illegal to ask someone to exchange sex for anything of value. It is illegal to ask someone to ask someone else to exchange sex for anything of value. It is illegal to appear to be asking someone to exchange sex for anything of value. It is illegal to benefit from someone else's exchange of sex for anything of value. It is illegal to be in the company of someone attempting to exchange sex for anything of value with someone else. It is illegal to come and go from a place where individuals exchange sex for anything of value. And it is illegal to make the exchange of sex for anything of value to appear to be glamorous as a profession. Don't hate me because I'm beautiful. But that said, this is not a brothel. There are no prostitutes at this address. These are not the drones you're looking for. I am not here to recruit. I'm not here for pimping or pandering. I'm just here to talk a little bit about the law, who I am, and why I don't like these laws. So we've been doing a lot of activism for a long time, and when it comes to the law, I listed all those things. The criminal code is really dense and thick, but when it comes down to what distinguishes commercial sex from, say, recreational sex, are elements of communication and association. So those are very vague. Ultimately, I think a lot of these laws, because of how we do prosecute a lot of these crimes, basically violate our ability to talk to one another and our ability to associate with one another. And so there is a long history of sex worker rights activism. In June, it was the 40th anniversary of a French sex worker protest in Lyon, where sex workers actually occupied a church. And they did this in response to heavy fines, police brutality, and ultimately a threat to separate sex workers from their children. This was a beautiful, beautiful protest, and I think what made it so beautiful is that all the women in the community joined the sex workers and said, "We dare you to distinguish us from the people you're prosecuting and persecuting." So it went very well. Things changed. So when sex worker rights are under attack, what do? Get dressed, fight back. Got a beautiful picture here of Sadie Loon from San Francisco. This was a campaign poster for Prop K. This was a failed, sadly, attempt to decriminalize prostitution in San Francisco. There's nothing there. Uh-oh. Let's try this again. Is it there now?
No.
Oh, we lost a beautiful slide. Okay. Well, in its absence, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what it was. Basically, this was kind of just an overview of sex worker rights. And the main point I want you to take away is for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, there have been many penalties and many ways people have tried to stop commercial sex. No form of punishment, up to and including the death penalty, has ever been an effective deterrent against people died, people are dying, it doesn't stop what's going on. There's also a lot of people who want to, on the sex worker rights activism, kind of create a dichotomy between trafficking and sex work. And there's a lot of good reasons for that. Sex trafficking is the big phrase that people use, but it's really not as black and white as that. The fact is there's a lot of people in the middle, and these laws don't help anyone, whether you are consenting to be in the sex trade or whether you're not. These policies put people in danger. So I don't know that it's helpful to distinguish. We need laws that protect people and their lives and their bodies. That said, there's also the kind of the another chant is we want rights, not rescue. Rescue's not on the table. The rescue is a lie. There is no rescue. So I don't know that that's helpful either. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about legalization and decriminalization, and I'm going to talk a lot about the Swedish model. That said, I have a little bit of a trivia question. At least this slide is working. I don't know why it comes up here and not there, but hey, technology. So which American city was the first to deploy a web-based anti-prostitution sting? They actually call this a reverse sting because that's when it focuses on buyers. I can't see anybody. So how many people think that it was, by sound of noise, San Jose, California? Did they win? No? No one thinks San Jose? How about Charlotte? Anyone think it was Charlotte? Got some folks? Was it Florida? Was Florida the first? How about Washington? Yeah. All right. And the winner is Everett Washington. In 1995 was the first to realize that there were ads on the internet. And they were the first to go in and start doing that. So there's been a lot of ways that sex work has been criminalized. The first street-based buyer sting when we started looking at people who purchased sex was in 1964 in Nashville, Tennessee. Obviously, we had that first internet-based buyer sting. In Eugene, Oregon, in 75, they started publishing names and pictures of people in the newspapers. Now they publish them on the web. Sometimes they're on billboards. Dear John letters are about neighborhood surveillance. That's when communities started encouraging people to go out, write down descriptions, license plate numbers. So that started happening. Surveillance cameras in communities started going on. And neighborhood action, those are signs, those are community watch groups, just in general, going after buyers. So there's a long history of that, and it's still happening. There's another slide that doesn't work. Sometimes bots are used. This is a very recent article going on in Texas where they have Ariel, Brooke, and Carrie are bots who are narcs. The thing that I really don't like about them is everything that these bots are asking about are essentially the screening tactics that sex workers used. So what they're doing is they're undermining our ability to get information about who might be wanting to spend some time and share in some companionship. Anything that we ask to screen our clients is incriminating. So it's going to be harder and harder to do that. Another broken slide. I'm so sorry. We had a little tech problem. We didn't get time to start up. There's also a lot of forms that people use. And there are license plate readers that are being set up in different communities. And when a license plate reader goes into a high prostitution zone, we often find that these are marginalized communities. These are communities of people who are living in poverty. And very often, these are communities where there's a lot of people of color. So it's very interesting how this surveillance is very targeted. Right now, there's about 55,000 people a year who are arrested for prostitution, but not everyone is arrested for prostitution or loitering directly. So there's probably more like 80,000 to 90,000 people a year in the United States who are being arrested for prostitution, even if that's not the official offense they're booked for. In 2014 to 2015, there were 3,285 people who were arrested for prostitution in New York City. 84% of them were women of color. In 2014 to 2015, 1,437 people were arrested here in New York City for patronizing a prostitute. 93% were men of color. And oftentimes that's because stings are done, again, in parts of town that are struggling more economically. So it is targeted. These policies are absolutely racist in practice. The workplace homicide rate for female prostitutes is 204 per 100,000. That makes it the deadliest job in America. The second deadliest job, by the way, is lumberjacking. 118 fatalities per 100,000. So it is almost two times as dangerous to be a sex worker in America as it is to be a lumberjack. The average sex worker is non-fatally attacked approximately once per month. And this is also, there's a wide disparity between people who work indoors or outdoors. These assaults are often coming from partners, but if you're not able to go to the police, there's nothing you can do about it, regardless of the source. And law enforcement officers are a pretty big portion of the violence that is directed towards people in the sex trade. Here's a raid, and the thing that I really want to draw some attention to is that that's ICE. Does that laser even work? What on earth was immigration doing at the Rent Boy raid? In fact, we see immigration is popping up pretty much everywhere when it comes to human trafficking raids. We see them a lot. They justify this on many grounds. We like to talk about people being trafficked, but just because somebody is working in a country that's not their own doesn't mean that they were trafficked. And a lot of these laws have been used to examine people's documents and to deport them. When we look at feminism, if we look at the concept of abortion, would we say that abortion is effectively decriminalized if someone could be deported if they were found trying to seek one? What is legalization? Legalization is Mr. Hoff. It is not legal to be engaged in prostitution all over Nevada, but there are some counties where you can. Over half of the legal brothels are owned by dentists. And I wanted to talk a little bit about why sex workers don't like legalization as a concept. If you work in Nevada, there's going to be a lot of hoops, bureaucratic hoops you have to jump through. If something can be done legally, it can be done illegally. And in this case, it's necessary to go to the sheriff's office where you will have a once-a-week medical exam, not the cushiest of locations. You are issued a card from the sheriff's department, and you're in a database. So if you're pulled over while driving, that information will come up. So that can be a little bit scary. In many of the counties, the people working cannot leave the facility where they're working, so you can't have your children with you. You will be separated from them. It becomes kind of a company town situation because you have to buy all of your supplies from the brothel where you work, even though you're splitting your profits 50-50. So condoms, lube, fuzzy handcuffs, you name it, you're buying it from your boss. So that is something that a lot of workers really, really don't like. And it also reminds you that legalization causes problems for sex workers of all kinds. One thing that I didn't differentiate in my language is that sex work is often the word that we use for any form of erotic commerce, whether you're touching someone or not. That can be camming or stripping or phone sex. And there's a lot of laws around a lot of legal sex work that get in the way of things. If you are a stripper, the way you can work is going to change from city to city. In some places, it's illegal for a stripper to touch their own body. In some places, they do have a whole part of the police department that's going to make sure a pasty is big enough or that the underwear is to the precise specifications. So that means that law enforcement officers can come right into a dressing room. They can start touching you and start sussing up how you're dressed and how you're working. Some of us may have been watching the news recently and saw that Stormy Daniels was arrested in an Ohio strip club. One of the justifications they used for that was human trafficking. In order to prevent the scourge of human trafficking, we had to arrest Stormy Daniels. So in general, legalization retains some of the worst aspects of criminalization. So what we want is decriminalization. And decriminalization means you simply remove all aspects of that from the criminal penal code. So that means we wouldn't have that kind of bureaucratic oversight, we wouldn't have the contact with law enforcement, and we wouldn't have as many arbitrary and capricious laws governing how we practice our trade. The Nordic model is something that's been traveling around the world. It actually was called the Sex Purchase Act. It started in Sweden, 1998, and it didn't really come from any particular cause. The people of Sweden didn't really care one way or another. Only about 25% of the citizens had an opinion. After they introduced the Sex Purchase Act, that number jumped up to 70%, but suddenly sex trafficking was an issue. So propaganda works. And this is being exported everywhere, which is kind of disappointing because there's a lot of good things happening in Nordic models. There's a great Nordic model of education on how we provide schooling or family leave, things like that, public assistance. So of all the things to export from the Nordic countries, we picked this. And this is where I say there is no rescue. This was never about protecting people. I have a lot of quotes, but this one is definitely stands out in my mind because this came right from Sweden itself, that it should be difficult. This should be hard. Anytime we point out the consequences that we face due to these laws that are endangering us, no one really cares because it was never about protecting anybody. This lovely, lovely feminist has a lot of good quotes about that, that all the negative effects are actually positives. Because again, this isn't about rescuing people. This is about ending demand by essentially any means that are required. It's not, there is no placement, there is no support. In the United States, we have estimates that there are tens of thousands of victims of human trafficking, but there are 150 beds and shelters for sex trafficking victims. We have no infrastructure in place whatsoever for anyone who is being harmed or is being forced into this trade against their will. All we have is deportation and incarceration, which have not been known to ameliorate the effects of trauma. The word that we use for this is carceral feminism. And carceral feminism is a, carceral feminism is a concept that we can work with the police state and try to solve things that harm women or gendered violence against women by using police and by using a criminal penal code. In 2012, there was a national overview of prostitution and sex trafficking. And in that quote, they even said, while it is necessary and just to assist survivors and that the expansion of those services is acutely needed, the interventions are not designed to prevent or to reduce the occurrence of exploitation. It is about ending demand. And boy, have these policies proliferated. There are end demand programs in every state of the United States. They're growing in numbers. This happened very, very quickly. And generally, people seem to think that if we can just, that there would be no human trafficking of any kind if there wasn't demand for commercial sex. But I think it's just as likely that we could end that demand as we could end demand for food. These end demand policies essentially turn people into spies against their community members. In Oakland, when they started, have the police department, basically because they're under-resourced, started training citizens to do their work. So they did a lot of this. There was a lot of support for it, but there were a lot of people who pointed out problems, and I think that a human rights attorney was quite right, that we are teaching people to turn one another in, to surveil one another under very arbitrary ideas. What does it mean to say it looked like you were cruising for a provider? What if you live there? What if you have a friend there? This is very, very vague. And what happens is if you are, they'll write down your license plate number, perhaps it came from video surveillance, perhaps it came from a license plate reader, and they send a letter. And the letters are very designed to be opened by mothers or wives. That's really the stated purpose, is to, if you can't necessarily prosecute somebody, make life as difficult as possible. In 2003, Congress barred groups that aided trafficking victims from receiving federal funds if they supported the legalization or practice of prostitution. This was a very big deal. We provide a lot of funding and support for the global AIDS struggle, and this is another gag policy that we have. Also in that year, President Bush committed $15 billion to the fight against AIDS, but again, he required that all recipients sign an anti-prostitution pledge. In 2013, the Supreme Court finally struck that down for United States-based groups. If you're out somewhere else in the world, I'm sorry. You're gonna have to fall in line with that. You cannot advocate for decriminalization in any way, shape, or form. You really have to get on the end demand train. We now have FOSTA-SESTA, the Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act. That happened in April. It was in the works for many years, and we had a lot of support from Google and Facebook, but unfortunately, there was something that happened in back rooms. If you know what some of those backroom conversations were like, please let me know, because I'm sure some folks here might have some insight into that. But essentially, Facebook and Google withdrew their support and were willing to move forward with FOSTA and SESTA. So what they did, essentially, was they removed Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And this was this is something that prevents liability from websites that have third-party content. So SESTA-FOSTA wasn't targeted at workers themselves. It was targeted at websites. And the idea that any website should be liable for what users are doing on it to that extent is going to have incredible implications for the internet that we use. The reason that we've had a free internet is because we do recognize that it's very hard to be in control of what all your users are saying. It also means that sex workers are a liability to a website. And because it's so vague, it's so arbitrary, what defines human trafficking, all of these laws and nothing really makes it precise. It means that anyone who's doing anything sexual is a liability. They need to go. So even if you're doing legal forms of sex work, you may find that you are unable to use the services that you once had to conduct your business. Craigslist erotic services reduce the female homicide rate by 17.4%. That was a paper that just came out this year. That was really stunning, 17.4%. That's a lot of lives. That is a lot of lives. And the reason why Craigslist could do that, you know, we're here, we're all hackers, we know, and no one would say that it's safe to open an email. But it is a lot safer to open an email than it is to stick your head into a strange car. That's just a fact. It is a lot safer to do your screening over the internet than it is to go outside. So people are being forced outdoors. As soon as Sesta Fosta passed, my biggest moment of cringing was knowing just how much the rate of street-based providers was going to increase, and we saw that within weeks. In San Francisco, our outreach team saw as many as 4 to 8 times the number of people who were working outside. Lots of people have smartphones, and by and large, people who do work on the street beat will have an ad placed. And so they're hoping to get as many contacts through the internet, and if they don't make enough money, they'll go work outside. But pretty much everyone was using ads, and they don't have that option anymore. The reason why I look at, you know, how much does it matter to distinguish trafficking from sex work, it's because choice is not an even playing field. Poverty removes choices. Race can remove choices in our society. Transphobia removes choices. All of these things limit the choices that people can make. But sex work is so often a choice of survival. And when you limit those choices even further, you can't even choose now to work on the internet. You have to work outside. That makes it dangerous. And anyone who works deserves protections. It's also interesting to see that when the internet makes things better, that's still considered a negative. Here we have Lieutenant Terry, who thinks it's a bad thing that an individual provider would make almost 4 times as much their rate. This was a beautiful screen capture from my pink book. The other thing that we used to use the internet message boards for was to share information and resources about STIs, about safe places to work, average hotel experiences. Is there anyone who can help me get a pay stub so that I can rent? Lots of folks came together, and so most of our individual commerce was about supporting one another, supporting our health, supporting our safety. In some cases, we did see a lot of workplace cooperation. On my Redbook, all of the providers on the message board said, hey, the going rate has been approximately X. What if we all agree right here, right now, on this message board to raise our rates by $50? People did. We can only do that if we can talk to one another, and we lost that message board. We lost that ability to communicate with each other. In another circumstance, when I was working, there was an individual who had had a little bit of a dispute with a provider, and she was willing to work it out with him, but she basically wanted a new Chrome notebook to work on. And he was like, no way. And so he emailed another colleague, and because we'd publicized this, she said, hey, I heard you had a bad time with so-and-so. I just don't think I can work with you or see you until you work things out with her. And he was like, what? So he went to the next person, who was me. And he was like, oh my, you know, like, I don't know what's been going on, but no one will see me. And because I had gotten the same message, I said, I don't know, dude, better buy her a Chromebook. Just do it. So we do work together, and we are able to negotiate and get a little bit more power simply because we can associate. In addition, a lot of our stings in San Francisco went down. The fact that between 2004 and 2007 that the yield of the street-based arrest could decrease by half is incredible. That shows you that how many people moved from the outdoors to the indoors. There are so many organizations that support full decriminalization. I'm really glad this slide works. There's another one just as big. If you can't read all these names, that's okay. You just need to know that I am not speaking alone. I am not speaking just from my bias. I'm not just speaking as someone who works with the Sex Workers Outreach Project USA. I'm someone who works with many, many people who are trying to fight for human rights. So we have a lot of big organizations that have supported us. One of which was Amnesty International, and I am so proud of them because they had such a big decided to come out in favor of decriminalization. They got a lot of flack, a lot of people left, but they stayed the ground. So they were incredible allies for us. The EFF, shout out to the EFF. The EFF has done a lot to help support this fight. When Prop 35 passed in California, it was essentially written as like an anti-puppy kicking bill. It was about stopping human trafficking, and the only thing that it did was it increased penalties that people faced. It also made it a little bit more vague, and it opened up that definition of human trafficking. Prop 35 in California meant that if I gave somebody a ride to work, I would be transporting a human trafficking victim. So it meant it was harder to get a ride. If you are, again, profiting off of somebody's labor, you could be labeled a pimp. So who wants to be your roommate if you're a sex worker? Who wants to be your landlord? That's a liability. If you are a minor and you work with another minor on a double, you are still a human trafficker of minors, even if you yourself are under 18 years old. A lot of these things are difficult. If there are more than two sex workers in one place, it can be described as a brothel. A lot of these troubles. And the EFF, I don't think was, you know, we weren't able to stop Prop 35, but they came out for us. And they're coming out for us again in the SESTA-FOSTA fight. There is a lawsuit. We're hoping to stop this and file an injunction. The government obviously is not a fan. But we're going to see what happens. Unfortunately, this is a global phenomenon. It's not just happening in the United States. Over in the UK, they are essentially looking at their own version of a SESTA-FOSTA to prohibit any form of advertising. Now, over in Britain, it's a very different case. It's almost decrim, but not really. Essentially, if you are an adult and you're behind closed doors and there's a money thing before a sex thing, that's private. But if you do something publicly, it's not. If you operate a brothel, it might not be. And there were a tremendous number of raids that went on recently. So they're mimicking what we're doing. This is definitely happening. There's also another bill that's kind of on the table right now that's being sponsored by Elizabeth Warren and Mark Rubio. So it's got bipartisan support. And that is to end banking for human traffickers. And what that's going to do is it's going to empower the state to work with financial institutions and to shut down bank accounts. This was happening informally for a while. They called it Operation Choke Point to try to target, you know, dubious, you know, internet or credit card transactions. A lot of different trades were being looked at, but definitely anything related to sex. That wasn't official. This would be a federal bill. And that would also mean a lot more surveillance into how we bank and what we're doing. We're seeing more restrictions in general around banking. It used to be a lot easier to put a cash deposit into an account. Now that's they're making that trickier, especially if you're trying to put cash into someone else's account. So we're seeing this. It's going to increase. And the question is really, what do we gain from that? What is the whole point if it's not actually rescuing anybody? And I've seen over time that there's often a target population that gets a lot of scrutiny. After September 11th, we heard a lot about terrorism, and it was necessary to surveil people to prevent terrorism. What we got left with was a lot of really bad laws that didn't necessarily keep anyone's lives safer. During the environmental kind of like activist movement, Environmental Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front folks were very heavily targeted. They found excessive penalties to stop the scourge of domestic terrorism. Right now, human trafficking is the word that they're using to justify a lot of surveillance. And no one benefits from having these license plate readers in certain parts of town. And there's a lot of technology that's being developed on these grounds. In terms of AI, there's the bots, but DARPA is funding a lot of good stuff to document people's faces. If you post an ad and your face is recognized and it goes into a database, you may have difficulty crossing a border at a later point in time. And it's easy to create this because we can, say, prevent human trafficking, but then human trafficking is so vague it can be used on anybody, and it's a lot harder to get it out. I'm sorry I missed a lot of slides, but I'm going to take questions for as long as I can on any of these topics, and I will be around to answer any questions anyone might not want to ask in front of an audience. I am not the only sex worker in this room. That's not even possible. There are other people that you're sitting next to who have been in the sex trade at one point. So always consider that. You don't know who you're around, and I certainly keep that near and dear to my heart. That said, I can't see anyone, so if there's a line of people who are at the microphone.
Hey, Maggie.
Hi.
So a lot of people have been following the legal fights against FOSTA-SESTA. But I think maybe a lot of the hackers in the room might also love if you wanted to talk a bit about the keep that fight up, but we're also going to take our toys and go home approach, what Red Umbrella has been doing and what Twitter's been doing to be like, fuck all y'all policies, we got this now.
Ooh, yeah. We are definitely form as much as we can. Twitter was basically, Twitter did a giant purge of our accounts because there was human trafficking on Twitter. There's still a lot of profiles that you can see that are active. Many of them are being shadow banned, which means they don't come up in search results. You can't find somebody unless you're already following them. This has also been the case on other types of social media platforms. Tumblr definitely likes to kind of shadow people out. So that's one way that a lot of social media is trying to figure out how to handle things. So Twitter, what a group of sex workers said we needed to have something, and they set it up through Mastodon. And interestingly enough, that was shut down because Cloudflare. There are only two organizations that have been basically shut down by Cloudflare: Nazis and sex workers. And we don't have a whole lot in common. It's actually something that's kind of always bothered me, that the first groups of people on the internet who were so censored and pushed off were sex workers and not Nazis for the longest time. We've always been enemy number one. And even though so much technology on the internet really has been developed because of sex, because of pornography, or the money that's transferred, we are the foundation of the technology we use today. But the technology that we use is now writing us out of our terms of services completely. So in some regards, it's like our allies have turned their backs on us. In other cases, we're seeing some people who are supporting. Twitter got back up. We found a different server. There's lots of services and people that are helping to create more and more private spaces. The difficulty is that makes it hard for clients to find. If anyone's ever had trouble like explaining email to their parents or grandparents, it's very difficult to explain how to be secure to a 70-year-old client who uses AOL. So our ability to do something private or to get out of the main pond is only as effective as our ability to bring our clients with us. So we have to do a lot of things with euphemisms or underground, and that's definitely impacting people's bottom line, which is why we are seeing so many more people who can't use Twitter effectively who do have to go back to the streets. And did that get a lot of what you wanted?
Mostly.
Yeah.
Is it over 100,000 at this point?
It's over 100,000. Yeah, Twitter has grown by leaps and bounds. Thousands of people were joining every single day. So the interest is still there. And if not the interest, at least the support or being an ally are pointing out that the user base demonstrates how powerful something can be. Yeah, I'll take the next one.
How does FOSTA-SESTA apply to jurisdictions outside of the US? Like websites that might be hosted elsewhere?
Mm-hmm. A lot of websites were impacted. The collapse of Backpage impacted sex workers all over the world. There were Australian sex workers who reported difficulties because they couldn't advertise on platforms they were used to. Those platforms were gone. So there were lots of people who were made vulnerable. And also to point out, When Backpage was raided, it happened about a week and a half after FOSTA-SESTA was passed, but it had nothing to do with that. All of these raids could have been conducted without this legislation. They always were, they will continue to be. Rent Boy was raided without SESTA-FOSTA. My Red Book was raided without SESTA-FOSTA. All of these, if there's something that's deeply criminal or if the government wants to shut it down, they always could and they always will. But this legislation, I think, is gonna make it more difficult for mainstream social media. And Backpage is quite missed. Backpage is quite missed. It also impacted personals communities. Craigslist can't have any of their personals ads, and that was a really important place for the LGBT community to find people, things like that. I imagine that this is going to trickle because sex workers are not just gonna stay on Twitter. They want to find clients, so you have to go where clients are. You have to go where people are. So I imagine that platforms like OkCupid, or other dating websites or Tinder are gonna start to get a little bit more claustrophobic as they start to eliminate people because sex workers are using those platforms to find people. So they're gonna have to do a purge. We've noticed that the like Skype or any of the Microsoft Xbox has a lot more heavy restrictions on the type of content they're allowing. Just because, again, the possibility that there could be human trafficking means they have to purge it. Next.
Given some of the difficulties you talked about with just navigating the existing banking systems, I was wondering if cryptocurrency is something that anyone in this space is using to try to not have to go through conventional banks.
Yeah. There are many sex workers who use various forms of cryptocurrencies, some of whom did quite well recently. There's a lot. There were definitely some sex workers who are no longer in the trade. So good for them, good for them, the folks who are able to use that and use that well. I imagine that cryptocurrencies are going to continue to grow in many different ways, but they're not always as evenly accessible. It can be hard enough to get a client to like understand how to get an envelope for cash, let alone some cryptocurrencies. So again, it's not necessarily, sex workers can have it, use it, accept it. But if their clients don't, it can be really difficult for it to be effective. But cryptocurrencies are gaining ground in all kinds of sectors. So I think the more people use it in general, the more it's going to be an option for people who are in the sex trade. Yeah.
Did that person get her Chromebook?
Could you repeat that?
Did the person who you were telling the story about get their Chromebook?
Oh yeah, we got her Chromebook. The funny thing is that was someone who was looking for a niche service. So there really were only like a handful of us. So if your workplace is about six people, it's pretty easy to get them organized. And yeah, that worked well. Yes.
Hi, you mentioned human trafficking being used as sort of a scary buzzword.
Mm-hmm.
And I've definitely seen that myself. It was really disappointing to see some of the more liberal politicians in Congress come out in support of like SESTA and FOSTA, and mm-hmm. you mentioned Elizabeth Warren. So I guess my question is, to what extent do advocates like yourself have sort of a voice or a seat at the table in like city councils, state houses, and Congress around the country?
Oh, that's easy to answer. We don't. None of these policies or policymakers have consulted sex worker rights groups. Right now, human trafficking has a lot of grant money. A lot of money is going into human trafficking, but no one seems interested in giving it to organizations, even long-established organizations like the Sex Workers Outreach Project USA. We kind of fight our way into different rooms. In California, we had a lobbying day. We got as many sex workers together as possible. We all got a bus. We went to Sacramento and we bothered people. There's a good saying by Flo Kennedy. She was an amazing activist. And she said, if you don't have a seat at the table, bring your own. And so I kind of think of that. We bring our own folding chairs, maybe put it on top of the table and make a seat for ourselves. So we are starting to be heard. There are a few politicians who are starting to listen to us in New York City. Actually, there was a summit with a candidate, Siraj, who did not unfortunately win his seat, but he actually made it a point to sit down and talk to sex workers and ask about the policies they want. So there's growing knowledge, but it's really not the dominant voice, even though sometimes it can feel like the dominant voice on spaces like Twitter. but not really Facebook. They don't like us there. We're growing, but I would not say that seat's very big, and these seats are being primarily occupied by anti-sex worker, carceral feminists, Vichy feminists, if you're nasty. But I hope that we will have more of a space. In the porn community, there was a lot of proposed policies that were on the table that were almost certain. In fact, some statewide California legislation, and sex workers organized and defeated it. So we're getting more of a voice, but it's not a loud one yet. We do need to be amplified by as many people as possible so that we can be heard.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
First of all, you need to know that your highlighter is amazing.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. So I was on a team of people who developed a news game surrounded changes to Canadian sex work law in 2014 with the defeat of the bill and then the introduction of the more terrible one that we're currently dealing with right now. And some of the changes to the laws that we have found that are most damaging involve what you touched on briefly, the profiting from sex work, even if you are not a sex worker. And two areas that that we found particularly effective have been bodyguards and drivers. Mm-hmm. So basically the people who are involved in keeping sex workers as safe as possible. So I was wondering if you could talk maybe a little bit about that sort of support network and how you are seeing SESTA, FOSTA, and other sort of changes to the legislation potentially eroding or dismantling those safeties the same way that we have.
Yeah. So one thing I found about sex work is that there's so many aspects to the work that it's hard to do by yourself, especially with a system that's out to get you. So one of the reasons why pimping can be such a strong business is because it is hard for a sex worker to do everything. You need someone outside of your work to help provide security, to bail you out, to any number of things that you might need support with. So drivers are folks that either an agency or an individual sex worker can hire to take them to work. A driver will wait outside and make sure that someone leaves safely. But they are profiting from sex work, even if they're not a pimp. In this case, oftentimes these are individual sex workers who are hiring people, who are essentially freelance contractors who provide support services. And they're all being labeled as pimps. The unfortunate reality is that many people who actually are traffickers and pimps are very organized, they're very smart, and they're not the ones being caught. It's usually the very well-intentioned people who aren't doing anything wrong that suffer the greatest consequences from these things. And this is very deliberate. In Norway, they had what they called Operation Homelessness. That's what they called it, and it was an attempt to get as many landlords in the hotspot for renting to sex workers at all. They wanted to make life as difficult as possible and get as many sex workers evicted as they could. So that's something that we do see kind of happening in the United States. In some cities, they even have very specific policies and legislation about renting to sex workers. If you are knowingly renting to someone in the sex trade, you're a pimp in the eyes of the law. So while SESTA FOSTA creates these third-party websites, they were a really great place for people to hire somebody. If you're looking to hire a driver, it's hard to find them. That's a niche service. So you need to go to a place where people are already in the know. And so SESTA FOSTA has eliminated all those places where people could hire those support services, which means we're going to be a lot more endangered because either we have to rely on a pimp or we have to go it alone. We can't even work with one another.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Fight the good fight in Canada.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So there seems to be a healthy level of paranoia about facial recognition. A lot of providers won't show face. Mm-hmm. But there also seems to be like a massive disconnect between the way female providers work. There's a culture of screening. There's Johns know what to expect with that. But with the gay provider community, it's totally different. And it's hard to figure out how to change the culture around that. And also, it's... I'm wondering if you can comment on like what level of paranoia is healthy considering things like voice recognition or geolocation if you have like a trap phone, but then you also have your regular phone in your pocket with you and you're traveling around, then you can be de-anonymized that way also.
Yeah. Absolutely. There are so many ways that we're being tracked. Reverse photo lookup is one thing that has ruined so many sex workers' lives because they'll use one photo for their working profile and they'll use that same photo on their kind of regular or their legal name profiles and they get linked. The reason why the face in the advertisement can be a little bit more of a liability is simply because those websites are all being raided, and so all those faces are organized and they're going right into the hands of the state. But there's so many other reasons why the face can be tricky or why people were covering their faces or obscuring them prior to any of this legislation. Some of the organization work that I did had to do with a local group of neo-Nazis who, I guess they were bored, started printing pictures of sex worker ads, looking for ones with faces so they could post them on telephone poles and things like that. So there's a lot of reasons why having your face available can be a liability. Voice recognition is definitely something that's going to increase, and any of the things that we have in our phone. What I found a lot of times is that the state can be very, very lazy, despite having very big dragnets. So when they have a bunch of information in one place with a lot of incriminating information, it's just there. It's made for them. But it's not always been the culture of people to obscure faces. For some people, it's a selling point. But I think we're going to continue to see that change. One thing I didn't mention on like the reverse stings, because I had to talk about cheapness in the law enforcement community, is they often do a reverse sting. That's where they'll post their own ad and rent a hotel room, and it's actually a sting for buyers. But a lot of departments are too cheap. They won't even rent like a Hilton room or post an ad. So they'll wait and they'll bust an individual provider at work and use her room. Like, they'll use her room and all of her appointments and her phone. So, you know, they're cheap. They like to make it easy. And when they use those ads, it's just because it's in one place. But yeah, there's a lot of other ways we're going to be tracked. And the unfortunate reality is that that might even be coming from porn images too soon.
Hi.
I know. I'm going to make sure that the next speaker has enough time to set up so they don't have tech difficulties like I did. So I'm going to see if I can take a couple more questions, but if the moderators will interrupt me if I go on too long, I really welcome that. Yes.
I just wanted to piggyback on the gentleman two before me about the activism and political thing. You talk about the politician, about all that, but do you guys get involved in the political clubs where the back rule deal are being talked about? Like for $20, you can join your Republican club, your Democrat club, or whatever club you want, and see those politicians like Suresh and Maloney come in and say Bitcoin is bad because it's being used by sex worker and we need to kill it. Mm-hmm. And I was in the room and I saw all those people go, yeah, we need to do that. And I was like, wait a minute, stop down, we need to change that. And maybe if you guys were in the room with us, with me or other people, we would be able to say, Carolyn, we hate you. And what are you guys doing to try to educate the population in that
sense? Yep. We are trying to get as many people doing that as possible. And this is also a question of like privilege and marginalization, is that I had the blessing of being able to learn a lot about how the political process works and what is expected of me if I do lobbying. So on the ground, we just have to teach our peers where to find the politics and how to engage with them. But we do that as much as we possibly can. In California, we've certainly been really involved. And I think also maybe the disappointing thing is that all of these politicians are our clients. They know. They see us. In fact, in the Bay Area, there was just recently a sex worker who got ripped off by a client who just so happened to be a Republican. And so she had no shame. She just like blasted him on Twitter and was like, this is his Twitter profile. He's a Republican politician. He's all about Trump. And he robbed me. And now he fears for his career because the big bad sex workers are ganging up on him. So we, yeah. The place that we're in the greatest contact with politicians is in the bedroom, and unfortunately that hasn't been enough, and we do need to get in more political spaces, and we need people to help bring us in. We need organizations who do a lot of that overhead to extend a hand. The Libertarian Party has just officially endorsed decriminalization. That is going to be a big step. But if you are concerned about this, contact a sex worker rights group, because I guarantee you there's a bunch of activists who are raring and ready to go. They just don't know how to access politics as we know it. So thank you. And I think that looks like time. Come see me. I'll answer any questions you have.